Welcome to the Virtual Refuge podcast on love and attachment. Please be advised that portions of the discussion toward the end of the recording are difficult to hear as a result of equipment challenges.
Welcome to today's Dharma Talk. I'm Sean Lindsay. I'll be leading the discussion, and with us today are Jason Harris-Boundy, Greg Woodhouse, and Kim Sika. Would you guys like to introduce yourselves and just say a little bit about yourselves so that others can develop some context for this call and discussion?
Sure. This is Jason Harris-Boundy checking in from San Francisco. I'm an assistant professor at San Francisco State in the Department of Management and a sixth-generation LDS member. My kind of prominent faith background, although I have a regular practice, a Buddhist practice here in San Francisco with a small group that's been going for many years in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master. That's probably enough.
Great. Thanks, Jason. Greg, you want to get go?
Okay. I'm Greg Woodhouse. I live not far from San Francisco, about 100 miles south of there in Watsonville. I also fifth or sixth generation Mormon, depending on which line you choose, but have been studying Buddhism for a number of years, and actually it was Thich Nhat Hanh's writings in large part that got me interested in the first place, so that's rather interesting that you should mention him.
That's terrific. Kim, you want to represent the never affiliated with Mormonism segment of this discussion?
Sure. I'm Kim Sika. My background is Christian Scientist, and I've been doing yoga for about 5 or 6 years, and actually Sean got me interested in Buddhism. So that's about it.
Great. I appreciate each of you joining today, and I look forward to your thoughts and contributions. I'm hoping that today's discussion, it'll start out with me talking a bit, but I hope it develops into a conversation, in part because today's Dharma Talk started as a bit of a conversation inside my head and a conversation that was going on for some period of time outside of my head with friends and acquaintances who largely found Buddhism and Buddhist teachings, you know, appealing in some regards and threatening in others. And I wanted to talk today a little bit about one of the threatening ones. So the conversation inside my head started by me reading the Second Noble Truth, which says that suffering is caused by clinging or attachment. And my response was, attachment equals suffering, really? And the Second Noble Truth spoke up and said, yes, really, it does. And my response was, but what about parents attached to children and husbands and wives attached to each other and soldiers to their comrades and ducklings to whatever they imprint on right after hatching? What about those kinds of issues? Aren't those the very essence of the very best parts of life? For today's talk, I wanted to focus in on exactly those things that are the very essence of the best of life. But I also wanted to focus in on the reasons and the ways that attachment is separate and distinct, or can be separate and distinct, from love. Traditional Buddhist teachings tell us that the path to liberation starts when we begin to perceive what the Buddha called the three characteristics of all conventional experience. Those are impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and no self, that is to say, the absence of an essential self in any aspect of experience. Mind you, they're not the only aspects of experience, but they're the three characteristics that, when seen fully and experienced and penetrated, release the mind from the afflictions and contortions of greed, hatred, and delusion. At the core, Buddhist teachings are that seeing how everything changes constantly, how nothing conventional is essential and personal, and how our experience is characterized by unsatisfactoriness, seeing those things, experiencing them in our bodies and minds, allows us to see how to free ourselves of them. And when we do, greed or clinging, hatred or aversion, and delusion or ignorance just fall away. Not because we no longer experience the desire to cling or avoid or remain deluded. We continue to experience life as life in all its colors. But greed, hatred, and delusion fall away because we see how clinging only makes sense in a world where impermanence does not prevail. Aversion only makes sense in a world where there's a separate and essential self that can be protected from everything else. And delusion only makes sense when our perceptions are so clouded that we don't see clearly what is right in front of us. Buddhist practice, practicing the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, enables us to see impermanence, the fluidity of everything. And when you see the fluidity of everything, trying to hold on to a particular configuration of existence is no more sensible than grasping at the wind. Buddhist practice enables us to see how completely enmeshed in existence we are, making aversion utterly impossible. And Buddhist practice hones our perceptions to the point that mistaken understandings simply dissolve in the clarity of view and seeing. So the three characteristics are incredibly important aspects as we start to bring those into relationships. But one last point of clarification, the teachings about the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and no self, those are not intended to be understood as, or even, it's not even particularly useful to think of them as conceptual learnings. Memorizing the list doesn't effectuate a change. Looking into your own experience with eyes wide open and seeing that, in fact, change and impermanence does characterize every moment of existence. Seeing, in fact, that suffering and dissatisfaction does arise in every experience again and again, as often as we cling to something or retract from something that doesn't please. And in seeing, in fact, that delusion, whether gigantic or incredibly fine-grained, does characterize almost all experience in some way. Seeing those experiences arise again and again and again and again in your own life, that enables you to change how you interact. At that point, it isn't some kind of quasi-noble ascetic renunciation that leads you to transform your existence. It's just rationality. You'd no more follow your instinct to cling once you see those things clearly than you'd indulge in an odd impulse to stick your hand in a buzzing cuisine art. I got into a discussion with my father on our most recent visit a couple of weeks ago, and he was accusing me of unnecessary asceticism or obsessive discipline, which is kind of funny if you know me, because I'm not an obsessively disciplined person. But he was perceiving me that way. And it occurred to me that perhaps the way to explain it to him is to say, because he and I do river trips, and we often enough find ourselves in the desert because the river that we travel down flows through the Red Rock deserts of eastern Utah. And we both have a healthy respect for contaminated water, Giardia, because we've had some close friends who succumbed to Giardia. They didn't pass away, but they lost 40 pounds of body mass over the course of a couple of months of terrible conditions. Just from a sip of otherwise apparently clear water. And I said, it isn't asceticism to set aside these things if the reason we're setting them aside is because we see clearly. If you're thirsty and you get up to the desert and you find a bucket of water, it may look really appealing to drink it. But if there's a microscope right beside it and you put a drop of water on a slide and you look at the slide and you see Giardia contamination in the slide, suddenly drinking from that bucket isn't an act of sacrifice or discipline or renunciation. It's just common sense. You don't drink the water. You go look for something better. And similarly, in the things that get given up in Buddhist practice, if we're giving them up as our insight is deepening, it isn't a big act of self-sacrifice or asceticism or self-discipline. It's just good common sense, like avoiding a bucket full of Giardia contaminated water. So impermanence, no self, and suffering are the three characteristics that the Buddha said characterize all conventional experience, and that the perception of which can lead to awakening. Those are the basic insights. But now let's go back to the good kind of attachment that we were talking about, or the kind of attachment that we in Western society call good. Among the archetypal demons of our Western society, I think, are robots. I just happened to finish watching the Prometheus movie, which is basically a poor offshoot of the original Alien movie. But if you saw either one of those, both movies are characterized by human-shaped robots that are unreliable. They're working according to their own agenda. They look and act like sometimes like normal people, but inside they're just mechanisms acting out pre-programmed settings. And we don't tend to know what those settings are, and so they seem very vaguely threatening. In those movies, they're both incredibly threatening. But ever since we figured out how to turn into metaphor Newtonian physics and to digest behavior into Darwinian reinforcement patterns, we've kind of built these robot demons in our minds. We've amplified our imaginings of mechanized thought and action. And for many people, the only sanctuary from that demon is emotion and feeling. Whatever may be true of our rational minds, we remind ourselves that at heart we're also sets of feelings, and the feelings comprise a counterpoint to the rationality, together yielding the conflicted, messy humanity that we've come to love in families, tolerate in politics, and creates endless postings on Facebook about people who are outraged by something and want everybody else to be outraged by the same thing. But at any rate, we use that feeling-thinking spectrum to tell us why we don't need to fear all the people around us. That archetypal demon of our society rearises in lots of movies, the sociopath who we imagine lacks any human motivation, the Nazis who took instructions like automatons. These are the avatars of robotic archetypal demons. They're not the only archetypal demons of our society, to be sure, but they're in the pantheon. So into a society pre-programmed to fear such things steps Buddhist teachings, which, especially in the hands of some translators, can sound distinctively like the robotic demonology of Western civilization. How on earth can it be a good thing for us to give up the attachments to children, to spouse, to country, to mother ducks? Wouldn't that be giving up the feeling side of life, the only thing that stands between ourselves and our worst demons? Let's hold that question in mind for a moment, and I'd like to take a quick dip into one more set of Buddhist teachings that will finish setting the table for this discussion. And this is the concept of near enemies of certain characteristics. Compassion is a supreme virtue, but it has a near enemy, and the near enemy of compassion is pity. It has some of the same surface-level outward appearances of compassion, but it is defined by the separation that it insistently maintains between the sufferer and the one feeling pity. And most importantly, it doesn't ever interconnect the two people. It's always one-directional. And similarly, the near enemy of joy for another's happiness is envy. So you get the idea of near enemies. Well, the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. Think of the distinction between the two this way. A central characteristic that you want in your emergency room doctor is equanimity. You want her to be completely unflappable. You want her to be unhorrified at an accident victim being brought into the ER in pieces. You want her to be unsickened at the sight of a teenager who slit his wrists. You want her to be unrepulsed by vomiting, bleeding, and pus. You want your ER doctor to be the model of equanimity. Internally calm, taking an intelligent and educated and skilled approach to every situation that it confronts her. Never indifferent, never bored, never distracted, but fully present and aware and engaged. In a word, equanimous. But also what we don't want in our ER doctors is someone who is even-handed. Now, I come to this discussion with a perspective. I've been to the ER about a zillion times, maybe half a zillion when I was younger and when I'd break something or be sick as a dog in the middle of the night or whatever, and at least another half a zillion as the father of three sons who would break something and get clocked in the head and not be able to remember life from one minute to the next or whatever. But one visit stands out in my mind more than others. It was Christmas Day years ago, and we had enough snow that week to make sledding a realistic possibility. There's a creek that runs through the low parts of our neighborhood and a few backyards back up to that creek park kind of area. And some of our neighbors had built makeshift stairs out of railroad ties leading down to the creek. Well, with enough snow and enough boy brains, railroad tie steps covered in snow start to look like terrific chutes to get your sled or inner tube or piece of cardboard or whatever to get it going really fast. And after figuring out how to get the maximum speed possible out of the railroad tie steps, boys naturally turn into how to make it more thrilling, how to make it more dangerous. So my oldest son thought several years ago on Christmas Day, if sitting down going forwards over these railroad ties is good, lying belly down and going down backwards has to be even better. But he bounced as he went over the last railroad tie, and he hit his chin on the tie. His tongue had the misfortune to be between his teeth, and his teeth had the misfortune to crack together, and his jawbone had the misfortune to meet directly with the railroad tie, which left wood splinters embedded in the bone of his chin. Long story short, by the time I got down to the creek after some other children came running back up to get me, he was a bloody, bloody, bloody mess. My apologies to our friends from England. I don't use that term disparagingly. I hurried him off to the emergency room, again, carrying him in. Now, all of my experience with emergency rooms is that they always involve a lot of waiting, which to my mind as a patient can feel exactly like indifference or even-handedness. But when I walked in carrying my son, who by that point had been bleeding all over my white T-shirt for 10 or 15 minutes, I was drenched in the yummy blend of saliva and blood. And to the ER crew's credit, we did not get even-handedness. Instead of take a number and take a seat, we got, don't sit down, come on back, we'll figure out the paperwork later. And all the people who were sitting in the waiting room when we arrived got delayed a bit longer than if we'd never showed up. Even-handedness in that kind of a setting is not equanimity, it's indifference. Mind you, while experiencing indifference, or even in its more palatable form of even-handedness, we feel like the other doesn't care. It's often enough comes about because of the other's own self-defense mechanism to protect them from things that we can't always see very well. their fears, their perceived weaknesses, their perceptions of inadequacies, their being overwhelmed, or whatever. So I'm not saying we can judge those who seem indifferent or robotically even-handed, only that we needn't automatically assume that the only choice is to be attached or to be indifferent. Equanimity allows love and attention and urgency all to manifest when causes and conditions call for them to arise. In my life, I've encountered people who were even-handed, who were so careful not to be partial with their love that rather than loving completely those whom they could, they titrated out their love in equal measures to all, whether close or far, spouse or stranger. Sometimes we're fundamentally too afraid of getting attached, and we swing back to the other end of the same stick, making the mistake in white and black rather than the black and white version, but a mistake nonetheless. I think some of it comes from a perception, probably accurate, that love is a pretty hot fire, and some go even-handed in order to avoid getting burned. A slightly different version of the same problematic response is avoiding attachment, which is merely clinging to the denial of human attachment needs. Anyway, often enough, in Buddhist practice, we encounter some of the basic insights of Western psychology, and this is one of those occasions. The Eastern version of the insight is this: clinging and aversion are opposing manifestations of the same basic impulse. Attachment to something you want is exactly the same as aversion to the opposite of what you want. The Western version of the insight is similar. It says, whenever we create a concept, we automatically create and define its opposite. As soon as we invent good, we also invent evil. Good is defined by what is not evil, and vice versa. Okay, so now I promise, back to it, attachment and refusal to attach. Each is the other end of the stick from the other. Attachment is the other end of the stick of avoidance of attachment. Avoidance of attachment is the other end of the stick of attachment. So now I've confused things even more. Do we seek to avoid attachment, but we also seek to avoid the avoidance of attachment? Yes. Does this mean we should just forget the whole enterprise of awakening, go back to munching Cheetos on the sofa and watching Olympic trials? It might not be a bad choice, but I have a thought that there's a better alternative out there. And for this, to talk about love and attachment and how I think they do work and can work in a Buddhist practice context, imagine a tapestry. Tapestries are made of threads, vertical, up and down, and threads that weave into them horizontally, right to left. And they weave in different colors and different textures. But each thread is connected to every other. Each connection in every of each thread is distinct, however. Let me back up and add Indra's net to the story. You've heard of Indra, the Hindu pantheon of gods. He has a net. At each junction of the fibers in the net is a jewel, and each jewel reflects not only the light that strikes it, but it also reflects all of the light that strikes every other jewel in the net. And Indra's net has become a fairly commonplace image to talk about the interconnectedness of all things. But the same is true of tapestries. But, and here's the interesting thing about Indra's net, each jewel in the net reflects mostly the jewels that are closest to it. The jewels that are closest to it reflect those closest to them, and so on and so on. But I think the same is true of the way we interact with people. The more connections we have with a person, the more opportunities we have to affect them. For most of us, at least, there is no person we have a greater ability to affect than our life partner or our spouse. During particular stages of life, the same is also true of parents and children, perhaps even more true. But as children age and develop, most of the time they develop minds and hormones that lead them to separate from parents and to individuate themselves, become their own people, form their own relationships. It can be hard for parents to let go of the role of controller of every aspect of experience and behavior, and it can be hard for parents, once the children have matured, to return to each other as being the most important person in their lives. But for lots of us, at any rate, the spouse, the husband, or the wife is the person with whom we are most interconnected. And it's not only the fact that we have numerically more interconnections with our spouses than we have with other people. It's that those interconnections can and do over time develop not only at superficial levels, but also at the levels of the soul that are pretty profound. And to be connected to someone else at such levels of your soul makes you profoundly vulnerable. One of my favorite professors in college reflected to me one day that she was amazed and dismayed to discover that even after every shred of love was gone from her marriage, as she was proceeding through the path toward divorce. Nonetheless, she and her husband still had the ability to hurt each other more deeply than anyone else in their respective lives could possibly. The fact is that being interconnected with another person not only gives us the ability to influence their lives for good, but we don't have the privilege of simply remaining neutral. We don't get to say, well, the last thing I want is to hurt my wife, but I'm just going to give a little less. When we open ourselves to another, until we thoroughly get the no-self experience that the Buddha talks about, we make ourselves frighteningly vulnerable. And when someone is vulnerable to us, our every action affects them. Even-handedness toward all is bullshit. It's either delusional belief that we're all nicely separate and distinct, or that we're all equally linked to all, or it's a self-defensive aversion toward fully open, fully energized, fully aflame relationships. Either way, it's a causing of harm to another, wittingly or unwittingly. So how would a person who fully experiences the three characteristics that the Buddha taught about, how would such a person who sees those things conduct himself with his wife? My perception, he would devote time and attention and energies and resources to her happiness and welfare. It becomes the bodhisattva vow, with the special emphasis on the people that you have the ability to influence and affect for good the most. In most instances, that means more time and attention and energy and resources get spent with the spouse than with others. We would be no more even-handed in our kindness and affection toward a wife or a husband than an ER doctor would be even-handed about treating a man with a temperature of 100 degrees and a young boy bleeding all over creation. Why? Because the husband or the wife knows the spouse's soul. He's seen where she's strong and where she struggles. She's seen where he is confident and where he stumbles. And chances are no one else on the planet has that degree of knowledge about the other. Only the spouse touches those points of the other's existence. And if we don't extend ourselves to help them, no one else will because no one else can. That doesn't mean, of course, that in any given moment a wife or a husband gets 75 or 90% of a person's attention. Sometimes it's the husband who has a 100-degree temperature while the neighbor has a compound fracture. But the more interconnections, the more opportunity to be of benefit. And I'd argue, because of the depth of connection that I mentioned, the more benefit that may be able to be received. In such a context, then, how is attachment a bad thing? How does attachment foul up otherwise perfectly useful love? I think it's this way. Clinging requires an object to cling to, something steady and unchanging. Insisting that the other doesn't change, when in fact the other is changing in every moment of every day, causes discomfort. Questions start to arise in the other's mind. I no longer look the way I did when we were married. Will she still love me? Or I don't understand our relationship in the same terms as I did 5 years ago. Am I betraying him? We started this marriage under a set of assumptions that I can no longer support. Should I pretend otherwise? When we allow our beloved other to be a living, changing being, yes, we admit to ourselves the possibility that that beloved may change in ways that lead us apart rather than together. We permit ourselves to acknowledge that we may not have forever with what we have today or what we had yesterday or last year or last decade. But what else happens in that moment? It's an expression of profound faith and love to desire for the other, that the other grow and develop and transform, and that we will not try to freeze the other in carbonite. For those who may not be familiar with carbonite, you guys know what carbonite is?
Yeah, Star Wars.
Exactly. So Darth Vader captures Han Solo and promises to deliver him to Jabba the Hutt, and he freezes him in carbonite. That has been my favorite metaphor from all of the Star Wars movies, because we constantly want to freeze our beloveds in carbonite. We want to put them into a stasis field where they cannot change from the way that we want them to be. So back to the point. In the moment when we allow our beloved to develop and transform, when we do not insist that they freeze aspects of their life in carbonite to satisfy our attachments and clinging, we set them and ourselves free, but we also set ourselves dangerously vulnerable. And I think the fact that it makes us vulnerable is why we cling. As much as we'd like to be able to predict and control change, especially change that affects our most profound relationships and degrees of vulnerability, we can't. One face of the ultimate mystery of life is this: we don't know and can't control what the next moment will bring. Well, we can try to predict it. We have weather forecasters and stockbrokers and prophets and fortune tellers who all do their best, but the farther out their predictions go, the less they get right. And when we get to the point of completely knowing or thinking that we completely know a loved one, we've actually stepped outside of the realm of experience and into the realm of concept or conceptuality. Because experience is constantly changing, shifting, moving, transforming, flexing. Concepts, not so much. But the tighter we hold to our mental model of the one we love, the more we constrict the living being, the more we deny them the freedom to develop and transform. It gets an order of magnitude more complex, of course, when we take into account not only our desires and attachments toward our loved one, but also the loved one's responses to our expectations and hopes and desires. And as we attach ourselves to a concept of an unchanging loved one, the loved one too can attach to our concept of the loved one, if that makes any sense. What happens when a person becomes attached to another person's concept of the first person? Well, resistance arises to one's own changing dynamics. We start to be concerned when we see changes arise in ourselves. We start to resist them. We start to push them back. Development of mind or body away from the loved one's concept of oneself can feel like betrayal of the other's love. Sometimes it turns into a subconscious anger toward the lover who has replaced the real experience of a real person with the mentally constructed concept. And by the way, this can happen when we attach to organizations and institutions, just as it does with lovers and loved ones. All that is to say this: because of impermanence, the ever-changingness of every aspect of experience, there is profound mystery in each moment, and that basic principle applies to attachment and love as much as it applies to the wind and the weather. As soon as we attach ourselves to a beloved, we've attached ourselves not to a real live experience of another person, which is dynamic and changing and impermanent, but rather we've attached ourselves to a mental concept, a mental model of a loved one. Why am I so sure? Because the beloved is only beloved in this very moment. She might be beloved again in a few moments from now, and we might try to conceptually fill in the blanks to create the illusion of permanence, but a few moments from now, she's going to be different than she is now. At a physical body level, she's going to be 5 minutes more away from her last shower, so she's going to smell different. At a slightly more refined level, she will have breathed in and out several times, replacing some of the oxygen atoms in her body with atmospheric oxygen. At a subtle mind level, she may have gone from looking lovingly into the lover's eyes to thinking about where to find lunch or why the lover decided to wear two mismatched socks or how to solve a geometry problem. And none of those things, smell, oxygen composition, or thought profile, means that we can't love them any longer. Attachmentless love is entirely capable of loving every expression of the beloved, every expression of every being, making them all beloved. But when love is tainted by attachment, the lover tries to wrest a changed being back to match the earlier concept of the beloved. Which brings me to another one of my favorite stories, this time a Greek myth about a guy named Procrustes. Some of you may be familiar with him. He was, by the account that I'm familiar with, something of a monster who lived at a narrow pass in the mountains. He'd try and get people to stay with him overnight, but the only way from one part of Greece to another was through the Procrustes path, or pass rather. But he was an odd sort of guy. He had an iron bedstead, but before he'd let you travel through the mountain pass, you'd have to lie down for the night on his iron bed. But if your body was longer than the bed, he'd cut off your feet to make you fit the length of the bed. And if your body was shorter, he'd put you on the rack and stretch you until you fit his bed. You get the idea, right? In an important way, attaching to a particular experience or set of characteristics in a beloved is to build a Procrustean iron bed so that any variation from the bed's iron measure causes suffering. And persuading the beloved to love the shape of the bed is just as immoral, whether it leads to foot binding or anorexia or gym rattedness or something more conceptual or more thought-based than body-based. So there's plenty of reason to avoid attachment. But what happens to love and the energizing power of love? Do we toss them out of the window in preference for Spock or Data-like asceticism? Or do we prefer the quiet of detachment and indifference? No way. Here's why. Despite the stories that our passion-conditioned minds tell us, the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion does not mean the extinguishing of being or sensation or perception or love or compassion. They only mean that we are awake to, clear-seeing awareness of, desires and aversions and mistakes. You ever had one of those frustration dreams? A dream in which you repeat the same actions again and again, experiencing the same stresses again and again, but all without ever solving whatever the dream problem is? Then you wake up the next morning, and you may not be particularly well rested, but you are at least relieved by your ability to, once you're awake, see through the dream situation.
We spend most of our lives dead asleep to how our life stories are shaped by greed, hatred, and delusion, how we are stressed by their results, how we cause difficulties for ourselves and others because of our lack of awareness of the dream that we're living in. Awakening doesn't mean the loss of love and the resulting detachment of indifference. Instead, it enables us to see a slight distance, the fraction of a moment separation between the occurrence of a stimulus and its connection to a pre-programmed response. And with practice and mindfulness, we can learn to see the space between those synapses, those tiny separations between stimulus and response. And once the space is there, we are free. Not free to choose anything at all. I'm not a believer in the magic worldview. But we are free to choose to take the programmed path or, alternatively, to take a different path, a path that we create in that very moment by being aware of the possibility of something else, something previously unpredicted or unknown. Loving another person is not binding them to a particular form or shape or set of beliefs or characteristics. Loving another person is creating a space for them to unfold, standing as a witness to their minds and their bodies, to their aspirations, their contractions, their mistakes, their successes, and their transformations through space and time, but not only to stand as witnesses, also to support, to foster, to offer ourselves unreservedly, to receive, embrace, honor, and release in each moment, to dance. So now I'd love to get your thoughts and your questions and your feedback. To get us started, maybe I can ask a question that can start to frame this. What is your experience with attachment in relationships? Is it entirely good? Does it have drawbacks? What do you think about these topics?
My experience with attachment is that it usually leads to jealousy. If someone likes someone better than someone else, or they give them more attention, then the person who doesn't get that same attention feels left out. So it usually ends badly.
And so that's from the perspective. So the person who's jealous is the one who is attached?
Your idea of even-handedness?
Mm-hmm.
There is no even-handedness, and they feel neglected, basically. So you have two friends, you spend more time with one than the other, then the one person who doesn't get as much time feels left out. Or you have the spouse with 100-degree temperature, the neighbor with the compound fracture, and you're spending time with the neighbor. It leads to jealousy in the long run a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking about most of the talk has been oriented from a perspective of how we can love without attachment. The same thing applies to us being and wanting to be the beloved. That's a really good perspective shift. I like that, Kim. Have you ever been in a relationship where the other person responded not to you, but to the other person's notion or idea of you?
All the time. Because that's all they really know, right? Because they know you, but you apply all these filters. So by the time they're reacting to you, they're reacting to what they think you are.
Yep. How does that feel?
It can be interesting. I think it usually leads to either arguments or an interesting discovery about the other person.
Yeah. One of the things that this kind of a process of unfolding, shall we say, can have is that it can cause some degree of upset in relationships that otherwise seemed, at least to one party, or maybe to both parties, seemed steady and stable. Now, steady and stable may also be stultifying, but this kind of an approach towards relationships allows space for impermanence, allows space for change and transformation, and that can be really upsetting. That can be really threatening. I don't propose to recommend it for everybody, but if you've started down the Buddhist path, it's presumably because you've already stumbled across greed, hatred, and delusion, and find suffering and impermanence is kind of you've started to see the suffering and impermanence as the giardia in the bucket of water already, and you're still trying to figure out a way to make that work for yourself. Greg, do you have thoughts along these lines or with respect to these questions?
Well, I know that one of the things that I think that maybe this is sort of telling about Western culture, but when we use the word relationship, we usually mean something very specific about, marriages and similar relationships, but there are relationships all around us as well. And one of the things I was thinking about is when we run into conflict, and this is something I really stumble across, is when things don't go well, maybe things aren't developing the way I want them to, am I the one that is clinging to a particular concept of what should be, or is it the other person, or does it not matter?
If I can offer what I think is a perspective on that. I don't know if what the right answer may be, Greg, but it seems to me that the Buddhist teaching would be that if you are suffering, it's your clinging that you would need to look at. There are different kinds of suffering, to be sure, and having somebody punch me in the nose is going to cause a certain kind of suffering that any amount of perspective shifting and letting go may not have a terrific amount of ability to reduce. But if I'm suffering angst, if I'm suffering difficulty, the second noble truth would tell me that I need to find in myself where it is that I'm clinging. How am I clinging to something that is trying to change despite my desire for it never to change?
Sure.
I actually went through that. Well, actually, I think all of us go through it whenever a relationship comes to an end or starts to transform. It happens when friends die. And we find ourselves angry and disturbed and distraught. And it's not to say that grieving isn't normal and natural. It completely is. But part of that grieving process is discovering all those places that I was connected to this other person where that other person is no longer. So usually it's the suffering that is the key for me to point me towards something that says, maybe I need to take a second look at this and find where it is, what it is that I'm clinging to about my friend who has died. It's been a long time since I was out in the world of intimate relationships, but it happened often enough, as I can recall, when someone would break up with me and I'd be sort of lost and trying to figure out where I was and how it could be that this person has broken up with me, similar to the experience that Kim was talking about. I felt some jealousy. I felt confusion. I felt disturbed. I felt angry. But in the end, I was clinging to a relationship that was bound to change and probably was never exactly what I thought it was in the first place, because I created this artificial construct of a relationship rather than actually connecting up with the other person and discovering, for example, that many of the people that I thought cared a great deal about me didn't, or they wanted something that I couldn't provide. Jason, do you have thoughts you want to share too?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. There's a bit of feedback, but we can hear you clearly enough.
Checking in with feedback. Sorry about this archaic webcam I'm using. I think that's what's causing it. First, Sean, excellent Dharma talk. Great topics and great insights. I really appreciate how you framed it, beginning with these three aspects from the Buddha of impermanent suffering and no self. Greg, I also like this last comment of yours about relationships. I think directly connects with this idea of no self. You know, when we're in relation or when we realize or become aware of the relationships we have with things around us, that sense of self dissipates again. The example I'd like to bring from my life currently, this is the thing foremost, and in fact it's the primary practice, or should be, and that's within my own family. I'm married, coming up on 19 years of marriage tomorrow, and I have two kids, a 14-year-old son and an 11-year-old daughter, and they have recently gone away for the summer. We put them on the plane. We've done this before, but it always shocks me at how sudden and impactful the change is. Yeah, we put them on a plane and they're spending the summer with their grandparents up near Seattle. And for all involved, it's a wonderful experience. The grandparents are young enough and energetic to take this on, parent them for the summer. And, you know, the context is wonderful. It's a 30-acre farm with horses, cows, sheep, chickens, barns, ponds, and forests. And so the grandkids are ecstatic. They can stay up late reading and play around. They also have to work. So, the other aspect, of course, the parents left behind in the city of San Francisco are like newlyweds again.
Wow.
And I just feel so lucky in some regards. So there's, you know, I'm quick to acknowledge the upside of this circumstance. But there's a lot of ambivalence. The other side, it's heart-wrenching to let go and to see them go away and see them not really miss us that much. To realize that they're going to change a lot and they are changing immediately. And so a lot of things come up for me in this circumstance. And they've now been gone nearly 2 weeks. And we keep in touch with them. But it's a lot of stuff comes up. And this discussion really frames a lot of it nicely for me. This idea of impermanence. That nothing is permanent. That things change constantly. Everything changes. And while these children are distinct individuals, this idea of no self can be conceptualized in many different ways or experienced in different ways. They're there, and we connect, and suddenly I'm there with them, or they're back here, or their village has expanded, their interactions with not just the grandparents, but the neighbors, the old friends of ours up there, all of these relationships begin operating, and I'm reminded of them simply because I'm forced to be removed from them. That is a curious paradox. And of course, there's suffering in a variety of ways. The most recent was just a quick story. Yesterday, my daughter called first thing in tears, sobbing. She had planned for a week to do a certain thing yesterday on Saturday. It's a once-a-year event there in the local community. Suddenly, plans changed, and she was forced to work on the farm all day yesterday. And she wanted some support, and she wanted me to intervene and to alleviate her suffering. And, you know, that was an interesting little circumstance. And then, I held off and said, you know, I'm not there, I'm not in charge. But I tried to help her just get to the present moment, to acknowledge what was going to happen and somehow make the best of it. And I said, what's the weather like? She said, it's pouring rain. But interestingly, this daughter genuinely loves the rain. Genuinely. When she looks outside and it's raining, it's something really, really positive for her. So we focused on that, on really spiritually on it. And that's in the end, what happened? They had a great work day on the farm. Some friends came over. They cooked outside on the fire. Had a lot of work done. And they got drenched. And there was a lot of joy. And so not really organized. I'm just rambling at this point, so I'll quit. But, a lot of those very immediate feelings and thoughts I have were getting the center of my practice. Are really informed by these principles, or these precepts, whatever we want to call them. Fundamental precept of Buddhism.
Thanks, Jason. I think the example of parents and children is a terrific one, in part because exactly the sort of experience that it sounds like you've been able to provide your children. I loved your point that they go off and they don't seem to need us as much as we thought that they would. I know that was completely the characteristic of my first son going away to college. He called us, I think, twice during the semester, and both times were to arrange for his return home. He was so delighted to be on his own and independent of us that we found. I don't think there was any mourning at all on his side. There were probably some pangs of loss, but he folded them into an adventure. And from our end, it was like, oh,
We had lots and lots and lots of connections with him that we'd been clinging to, and that were painful for us to let go of. But it was, you know, that's part of, I guess, what we have come to desire for our children. We desire for them to be strong and independent and adventuresome and more focused on what's in front of them than what may have been behind them. Or at least so we like to, so we like to persuade ourselves in order to console ourselves. But the same can be true of spouses. And sometimes people can grow together and twine together, and sometimes they grow apart. I don't have a great question to wind us up with. Do you guys have questions that you want to pose to each other or to me? Do you, Kim, do you have anything you want to offer as a closing thought?
I can't think of anything.
Okay.
Great talk.
Greg, do you have anything you'd like to offer?
Well, I guess only I don't want to be put it this way, is that partly because of my work, I'm a software engineer, partly I've just been thinking about the extent to which people trip over preconceptions. You know, they have an idea of the way things ought to be, and it blinds them to not only seeing how things are, but to seeing how what could genuinely be a benefit to them if they're willing to I don't want to say set aside their assumptions, but maybe think about them a little bit differently.
Sometimes all it takes is for me to have somebody point. I don't need other people to point out my assumptions, so that can be really helpful when they do. Sometimes all it takes is for someone to say, "Sean, you're responding to your assumptions rather than to what's in front of you." I had this happen a couple of days ago. I was very sore from a couple of workouts that I'd done, and I was hobbling along. And I was feeling sorry for myself, and somebody said something, and I don't even remember exactly what they said, but it sort of prompted me to think, oh, you know, if I had to choose between non-existence in this very moment or existence in the body that I have with the aches and pains that I have and the limited range of motion that I have and all of the other bright and glorious things about existence, I'd say yes in a New York minute to it. The only reason I was suffering is because I was attached to the way I'd felt a couple of weeks earlier when I hadn't had those aches and pains. And so when people come to you with, Greg, with preconceptions, and those preconceptions are creating difficulties, yeah, I wish there were a great way to help people recognize their preconceptions, how those differ from what's actually reality in front of them. But that's ultimately where each of us gets deluded. I think that's where most delusion comes from. Delusion comes from preconceptions, our beliefs about how things are or are going to be that don't actually match up with reality. And rather than checking the assumption against reality and saying, oh, that assumption number three just doesn't look like it's holding out, I better replace it with fact number three instead. Instead, we just continue to respond to the world as though it does conform to our assumptions. And they're wrong. And we bang our heads into a brick wall that we can't see because we've closed our eyes to that part. And that, of course, happens in relationships of all kind, whether intimate ones or business and professional ones as well, I imagine.
Can I pose just a quick question?
Please.
A large and ongoing question for me is really, and I guess why I love this talk so much, is this question of how to properly detach at the same time of how to develop a bigger, deeper love that's appropriate. And I'm just struck in the middle of your talk, you mentioned this idea of equanimity. And I really hope to investigate that a little bit better. It seems like that's part of the answer.
Equanimity is both, well, for those who are steeped in Buddhist teachings, it is both a step in the path toward awakening in the Theravada tradition, but it's also one of what are called the divine abodes, the ways of experiencing and practicing that are always beneficial. But one of the tricks about equanimity is kind of like being calm. I don't know what your experience has been, but I've had on occasions I've been through deep depression, for example. And I can't tell you how many people really sincerely thought they were helping me when they said, oh, well, you should cheer up. That would help. Telling somebody to cheer up who's depressed is like telling somebody who is not equanimous, oh, you just need to be have more equanimity in your life. What they're telling me is the result that I need to find, not the practice that will get me there. There are practices that can help develop equanimity, but also equanimity just comes from the basic experience of seeing the transitory nature of existence at a very fine and granular level that can come through meditation practice. But equanimity is one of those products of a meditation practice rather than necessarily something that you might practice toward. Actually, I think Thich Nhat Hanh has a few practices that are specifically aimed at developing equanimity. And if you'd like, I can hunt those references up and send them to you. So there are practices specific to equanimity, just like there are practices specific to loving kindness. But most equanimity that I've experienced in my life that has resulted from my Buddhist practice hasn't resulted from a practice that was specifically intended to create equanimity. Instead, it has arisen from the clear seeing of moment-to-moment awareness, seeing transitory things, seeing my own clinging causing suffering, seeing the Giardia germs in the bucket and going, oh, maybe I don't want to drink that. And when I don't drink it, I stand more equanimously. That said, I wish I could claim that I have the world's perfect application that will develop equanimity. It's a stumbling journey for me too. For me, the biggest concerns of my life have gone from being a profession and career to the health and welfare of my children as they grow into becoming their own adults and their own selves. But equanimity is totally available as soon as we get both interested in that avoids the indifference part, right? Equanimity happens when we get interested in something and we neither attach ourselves to it or cling to it, nor are we aversive towards it to try and get away from it. Aversion is actually a little easier for me to think about how to practice dealing with equanimity, because aversion is just turning towards it. The way to practice equanimity is to resist aversion, not to resist aversion, but rather to recognize the resistance of aversion, see what it is that your mind is turning away from, and turn toward it affirmatively.
I think your emergency room metaphor was excellent. Of course, maybe that has to do with the fact that I work with electronic health records as my profession.
You know, I was stunned, Greg, when I took my son in, because I totally expected to be told, take a seat, we'll get to you as soon as we can. And to have them, you know, now it occurs to me that one reason to take in a massively bleeding child, not only is for the child's welfare, but it's because all the people in the ER room were horrified when I brought in this bleeding person and we were both dripping blood all over the floor. So it might have been for the good mental health of everybody else. But yeah, that's the kind of equanimity that we all aspire towards. It's the complete opposite of indifference. Jason, if I had a secret weapon that would develop equanimity automatically, I'd be glad to hear about it. Or if you have one, I'd be delighted to hear about it. But I think it does come through all of the essentials of Buddhist practice and contemplation.
And comment that I especially like your concept of near enemies, because I think that it's very easy to stumble into the idea of thinking that indifference is a virtue, not really distinguishing between indifference and equanimity.
Yes, and indifference is the robot. It's the demon archetype of our society today. It's the Nazi guards and Nazi concentration camp operators who take orders and do them and are fundamentally indifferent to the outcome. But those are hobgoblins under our beds.
I appreciate those comments. It really resonates with my own experience that equanimity is an outcome. The more I practice, the more I meditate, the more aware I become, and the more I'm able to be or to try for the equanimity. I also think compassion just develops, you know, as it unfolds naturally, the more aware we are. And so equanimity maybe is a check on that, so that we don't, you know, get sucked over into the realm of pity or clinging or the aversion that can rise with those intense emotions that accompany compassion.
I like that insight, Jason. I think that it is similar to a point that I've heard or I've read the Dalai Lama make on a number of occasions, that there are two wings to the Buddhist approach to life. One is the wisdom wing, the seeing of no self and impermanence and suffering. The second wing is compassion, and no bird can fly without two wings. Not too much compassion. I think there's no such thing as too much compassion, but compassion that is not counterweighted or complemented by the wisdom of clear seeing, including the equanimity that comes along with it, tends to not sustain itself over the long term. And similarly, there's a kind of coldness to the clear seeing part of Buddhist practice and experience that is counterweighted importantly through compassion and the interconnectedness of all things. So I love that. I want to be respectful of people's time, and perhaps that gives us a good exit message. I very much appreciate all three of your participation today. I've loved this conversation, and I look forward to talking with you further online as well as in future talks. Thank you so much, and be well, please.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you all.
Thank you, everybody.